This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before the war in the Gulf started, Roger Fisher, the head of the Harvard Negotiation Project, suggested we could avoid war through negotiation. Well, things didn't work out the way Fisher had hoped, but now he's urging both sides to negotiate an end to the war. This morning's news reported that Iran was offering to mediate a settlement. I spoke with Fisher earlier today and asked him if he thought this was an offer worth taking seriously.
I don't think either side would accept a proposal simply because Iran said it was a good idea. I wouldn't ask them to. But a party that is neutral now, if they came up with a package that made sense, wherever it comes from, it doesn't have to be a big power. It doesn't have to be France or the Soviet Union. The Algerians helped us work out the Iranian hostage case 10 years ago. Not because they were powerful, but because they could talk to both sides. People, though, keep thinking a mediator has to be someone like the Pope or someone who has a great deal of legitimacy in the eyes of everybody. I pay more attention to the professional competence of talking and listening and not asking for early commitments, but generating a plan that meets their interests.
Who are you talking to behind the scenes?
I talk to a lot of people in New York at the UN from, I would say, all the countries. I'm saying, let's get a resolution on the table. Don't make any concession, but say, here it is. If they give a commitment to withdraw from Kuwait, a ceasefire will be ordered long enough to permit them to get out. We'll have some observation, a UN commission, or somebody to make sure they're moving in good faith to get out. If they don't, the ceasefire stops. If they do get out, at the end of a period of time, or whenever they're out, within 30, 45 days, whatever it is, all use of force stops, the economic sanctions stop. And then I say that the negotiation of all the other issues, Arab mediation of boundary and islands, something on the Palestinians, and it's a fairly simple package, and you try to make to get the bugs out of it.
So this is what you'd like to see the UN do, lay out the
terms. I'd like to see the U.S. support it. We've authorized force if they misbehave. No one has told Iraq what happens if they're good. No one has told them if they say they'll withdraw, what happens? Do they get bombed while they're trying to retreat? Do we attack them as they're getting out? That's a pretty strong deterrent from any steps to get out of Kuwait. So you want to maximize the pressure to get out by saying if you say you'll get out, there's a ceasefire to let you do so. And then you want to maximize the incentive to get out by saying if you get out, the war stops. We can negotiate everything else.
We're perhaps in a transitional period in this war, the period between it being an air war and a ground war. Would this be a good time to start a negotiation?
Oh, I think we want to make it very clear there's a way to stop the war. Even in World War II against Japan, the Potsdam Declaration clarified that unconditional surrender did not mean unconditional slaughter. The Allies stated exactly how to end the war. If you do this, the war will stop. We will have limited occupation. You can import raw materials. The military can live civilian lives. After a period of years, the United States will withdraw as soon as democracy is established. We set the terms, and that made it possible, combined with the military offensive, for Japan to quit. So we did not have to conquer Japan acre by acre the way we did Nazi Germany. The land war will be a disaster. We'll be killing lots of innocent human beings. A lot of our own soldiers will be dying. And for what? A result we don't even want. We don't want to destroy the country. If we go conquer Baghdad, I can see us arriving and the whole situation a mess of the heavy bombing. And we say, who's in charge? And they say, no one. You're in charge. What are you going to do about the wounded and the children and the homeless? What are you going to do about the hungry? What are you going to do about famine and food supplies and disease? And we'll say, oh, dear, why don't you take over? And they say, no thanks. Unless you guarantee me a $5 billion aid program, I'm not going to be the American puppet here. No, I think that winning that kind of war would be awful. And so I think now is a good time, before any land war starts, to work a way out, a way that we can say is victory for us because they're out of Kuwait, and Saddam Hussein can say, I was not totally defeated. I'm still an important Arab. I can call an Arab reconciliation conference. He can try and deal politically rather than militarily with building himself up.
Do you think our terms for resolution are unclear because our objectives in this war haven't been clearly stated either?
The tendency in a war, as the effort increases, is to increase the objectives. The more we spend in money and human lives trying to pursue the war, the higher a goal we want. I consider land war as though our troops were making yardage on a football field, grinding away a few yards at a time, and the politicians were moving the goalposts further away. We want total victory. We want an end of Saddam Hussein. We want democracy in this country. We would like to have an end of all chemical weapons. We'd like to have security in a new international order. We keep pushing things further and further away, and the troops have to grind and grind on, pursuing objectives that the politicians make. The time to set the terms is now, and if we have unlimited objectives, we will have unlimited war. We want to limit those objectives down to those we went in for. Deter aggression, avoid a bad example, liberate Kuwait. Period. We can deal with the rest politically.
As a negotiator, do you ever feel frustrated that maybe the United States doesn't really want to negotiate yet, that what they want to do first, perhaps, is to destroy Iraq's military capability?
There are many people in the United States who do not want to negotiate for two reasons. One, they think of negotiation as giving in. And two, they would like to do more damage before the war ends. I think both are wrong. I think that the damage we do to Iraq is also damage to us. I think we are antagonizing an increasing number of people in that part of the world. We're looking more brutal. We're starting to compete with Saddam Hussein as to who cares less about human life. We're taking him, this most ruthless tyrant I know, and we're saying, we don't care how many of your people we kill. We don't care how many of our own casualties lost. We are prepared to compete with you as to caring less about human life, caring less about laws. That is not a contest I want to enter into. Second, negotiation is not giving in. Negotiation is meeting someone to persuade them. I will negotiate with anybody. I'm more likely to persuade them than they are to persuade me. Are we afraid to negotiate? Do we feel our ideas can't stand up? That somehow if we start talking, we have to stay at the table forever because we cannot explain our position? We cannot clarify what we're doing? I'm really disappointed that the United States has not insisted on negotiation at all times. And even the day the war started, let's insist on meeting in Geneva, continue to talk and work out how this war can stop.
Saddam Hussein may be willing to be a martyr in this war. How do you negotiate with someone who's willing to be
may.
A martyr?
He's going to look at his choices. Right now, he says, if I say I'm losing the war, the Americans will step it up. If I say no, I have an option of better terms. I have an option of fighting on endlessly as they try and conquer acre by acre, and we may last longer than the United States. We may actually win this war if we dig in and hunker down. Americans may lose heart for it. Finally, if that doesn't work, I can be a martyr. I can set the entire Gulf on fire. I can go down in history. I will be an Arab who stood up to the superpower, and they could not impose their will. They just made a mess of it, and the Arab world will be anti-West for a long time. No, I think the martyrdom scenario may be very tempting to him, and that's one reason I want to make it very easy for him to stop the war before he shows us that he can hurt us worse than we think. See, each side has been saying, we can hurt you worse than you think. We've been saying our sophisticated hardware will be more destructive than you expect. And he's saying, my willingness to pollute the environment and set things on fire and destroy people and sacrifice lives, I can do more damage than you think. I'm afraid both of them are right. And the consequence will be disaster unless we use our intelligence, our guts, our openness, our humanity to stop this war and do so as quickly as we can.
Roger Fisher is the director of the Harvard Negotiation Project. Perhaps you've been so busy trying to keep up with events in the Gulf, you've been unable to follow what's been happening in China, where the leaders of the democracy movement have been standing trial. Coming up, China expert Orville Schell fills us in. First, a short break. This is Fresh Air. The war is providing the perfect cover for countries with dirty work to do. While our attention has been focused on the Gulf, the Soviet Union has cracked down on the Baltics. and China has been conducting trials of the democracy movement leaders who were arrested in the spring of 89 after Tiananmen Square. Orville Schell is the author of several books about China, most recently Discos and Democracy, China in the Throes of Reform. We invited Schell to discuss these trials and their significance.
Well, one of the most sort of well-known young student who was recently sentenced to 4 years was Wang Dan, and he was the triumvirate of leaders of the democracy demonstrations in the square, and he was often referred to as the heart of the movement, in the sense that he was a rather sensitive, intelligent young student from Beijing University, 22 years old. I mean, you have to try to imagine what it's like for a kid of that age to be sort of thrust into a leadership role of this monumental movement with hundreds of thousands of people in the square. And he was picked up shortly after the massacre. There are a number of other people. There are two very interesting, slightly older leaders, Wang Juntao and Chen Zeming, who were the head of a most extraordinary sort of... Well, how to describe it? It was kind of like a liberated zone within China. It was a private research organization that had polling facilities to take opinion polls, had publications, had correspondence schools, it had magazines, book translations. And it was one of China's sort of first and earliest private think tanks, in a way. And in this sense, was enormously threatening to the government because, unlike people who might just have wandered into the street with one grievance or another, here was an institution set in the heart of Chinese communist society, which allowed alternative avenues of social mobility. In other words, people could make a living, people could express themselves, people could acquire status, could acquire prestige through this sort of alternate private structure. So we should watch for Wang Juntao and Chen Zeming very carefully, because within their sentence, we will also see a judgment on this very interesting new development in Chinese communist society of a civil society. In other words, of people outside of the official sort of embrace of the Chinese Communist Party. And it was this, you see, that led up to the demonstrations, and it made the demonstrations more than just a few people protesting. It made it an expression of an alternate power center that was challenging the Communist Party and in effect, beginning to make China into a pluralist society.
You know, one thing that I read about Wang Dan, who you had mentioned, the 22-year-old student leader, he's number one on the police list of most wanted students. I'd read that he'd cooperated with the authorities, and that gave him the permission to read in his prison cell, but that his reputation in China was declining because of his cooperation with authorities. What could you tell us about that?
Well, I've heard similar rumors. It's very hard to know, but one thing which we can say is this, that the more famous a prisoner is, namely the more well-known he is in the outside world, the lighter he tends to be treated within China itself in the penal system. This is a kind of a curious phenomenon, that if someone is respected or known abroad, then he acquires a respect and luster within China itself. So there's a curious process that goes on of sort of co-optation through light treatment. The very people that the government knows will have some impact when they get out because they are well known. What we really, I think, need to worry about are those people whose names we don't know, or whose names are known but who are not famous and who there's very little agitation or support for. So Wang Dan, in a way, is a kind of a celebrity prisoner. And I think, you know, it is this that our government sometimes doesn't appreciate, namely the power they have in affording some measure of protection to people in China who have been detained or arrested, people who really have no protection, either legal or otherwise, within their own country.
What can you tell us about the language of the charges that are being brought against the people on trial? I mean, everybody seems to be accused of being a counter-revolutionary, which has this really old-time hard-line ring to it.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. I mean, they speak of the black hands of counter-revolutionary instigators. These dreary, sort of old-fashioned Marxist allegations. It's as if their imagination has failed them, and they really don't know what else to do. They're stuck in this rhetorical time warp. But, you know, on the other hand, Terry, I must say that much has changed in China. And we must not assume from this rather retarded phraseology that they use that we've been plunged back here into the Cultural Revolution again. In fact, China has been hooked up to the outside world. The outside world does have enormous impact on what goes on there in terms of its sort of appraisals of that country and how Chinese react to it. And also, China has broken apart. The old ideology has fallen. No one believes in it anymore. And if there was one thing that really impressed me about the last trip I made to China in November, it was that even though on the surface one finds people very numb and quite submissive and more or less just waiting for some old leader to die, underneath there is a cauldron of cynicism and mockery for their leadership. And what this suggests to me that although the rhetoric has snapped back to the 60s or 70s, and although on the surface there's a curious socialist calm, and intellectually speaking the country is dead as a doornail, underneath there is a whole new sort of psychological environment in which people dare to project their grievances outward against the government rather than inward against themselves, which was the model of the past, namely that if you were accused by the government, the tendency was to believe that you were wrong and to try to find the out damn spot, to find the spot within yourself, to join the government in attacking yourself. And this sort of overweening desire to reintegrate yourself back into society with mea culpas. Now you don't find that. Now you find people speaking just in the most abusive fashion about these octogenarians, about this failed ideology, and about this sort of collapsed system, which is propping itself up per force of arms rather than per force of a belief system.
But when you hear people speaking out against the government, are you talking about hearing them in private places or in public places?
In private places. But this is very significant because, 10, 15 years ago, people wouldn't dare speak out in private. Not only that, I think in a lot of cases, people didn't even have these kinds of subversive thoughts. And I think this is the real effect of the democracy movement of 1989, is that it has changed the climate, the intellectual and the psychological climate of the country, where people dare to think dissenting thoughts, where they dare to be independent. And what we've seen is this recrudescence of a private world, a world which did not exist before because it was too fearful. We see a society that has begun to develop margins, both intellectually and economically. I mean, we have private enterprise still everywhere. So this means that people can escape from the center. They can retreat, sort of like Robin Hood, with his merry band, off into the protection of Sherwood Forest. There are Sherwood Forests everywhere in China today. Perhaps not so many politically speaking as there are economically. But this means that people can find havens outside of the central control of the government. And again, this is what has been most threatening to the party, and this is why they have treated these prisoners so severely and why they are so ambivalent about, all these signs of capitalism that they themselves are cultivating because they need it to produce, to have a healthy economy.
What are the vulnerabilities of the leadership now in China?
Well, I guess the most obvious one is age. I mean, you have Deng Xiaoping, who's, 86. You have Wang Jun, the vice president, who I never can quite remember how old he is. He's so old. He's heading towards 90. You have Yang Shangkun, who's in his high 80s. He's president. You have any number of people who have not even been seen in public because they can't walk. and this is, creates the climate. There's an expression in Chinese of listening to the blathering dreams of octogenarians, and this is sort of the attitude towards these people. Why don't they let go? I mean, why are they hanging on? And how can a country be possibly led by people who have faded off into senility and you know, and are physically unable even to rise from the bed?
How do you think the Gulf War is affecting China now and affecting China's diplomatic relations with the United States?
Well, as you know, after announcing that we would not meet with any high-ranking officials from China, George Bush in December met with a foreign minister. This was after the Chinese deigned to abstain from that Security Council vote, which allowed the United States to contemplate the use of force on January 15th. This was our payment to China. So China has really had a field day, sort of rehabilitating itself on the international front. China reminds me a little bit of Richard Nixon in the sense that, you know, in each case there are high crimes and misdemeanors behind the screen, but in each case neither Nixon or China have been able to admit to this fact. They go on as if nothing has happened, as if they can kind of act out the form of a responsible, intelligent citizen that people will forget. And Iraq and the Persian Gulf situation have allowed China to play this, to act out this role of being a responsible world power, and to send their foreign minister around and to say they don't believe in the use of force, which, by the way, was the reason why they said they abstained from the Security Council resolution. So they have, whether they have succeeded or not, I can't say, but they hope they've succeeded in a public relations campaign to rehabilitate themselves in the eyes of the world as a stable, responsible world actor.
Orville Schell, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Journalist Orville Schell, his latest book is Discos and Democracy, China in the Throes of Reform. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.